The Mike Lupica Podcast.
We are back now with the great Mike Lupica. He's one of the country's
most prominent
sports
columnists. Mike Lupica has covered just about every sport.
Candid interviews with legends he calls friends.
I was talking to Jordan about Woods after the basketball game the other night. Everybody in sports to be the next this guy, the next this guy. And Michael said, no, he's the first Tiger.
In your face questions.
How much of a dope is he?
Compelling.
A $1 billion industry, the biggest we've ever had in sports in this country, often comes down to a flip of the coin.
This is the Mike Lupica Podcast. Here's Mike Lupica.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on the Mike Lupica Podcast. Today, we will be joined by Martina Navratilova. But before we get started with Martina, I want to tell you about Upstart. Upstart has revolutionized how we borrow money by going beyond the traditional FICO score to offer personal loans, taking into account factors like job experience and education when determining your interest rate. Checking your Upstart rate is free and has no effect on your credit score. Your Upstart rate check takes just 2 minutes, and if you are approved, you can get your funds as soon as the next business day. They make it quick and they make it easy. The path to financial freedom can look awfully bleak when you have high interest debt. And if your FICO score isn't great, it can make breaking out of that revolving debt cycle harder than it needs to be. Thankfully, our sponsor Upstart is revolutionizing the process of personal lending. You have to check them out. Hurry to upstart.com/Lupica to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes 2 minutes and won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/Lupica. Welcome back to the Mike Lupica Podcast. And we are joined today by one of the favorite subjects I have ever had in a career that's gone on about 9,000 years. I first met Martina Navratilova when she was a teenager who had come to this country from Czechoslovakia. And for my money, and I don't even know if this is a generational thing. She's the greatest women's tennis player of all time, and I'll tell you why. She won 18 singles majors, 31 doubles majors, and oh, by the way, 10 more in mixed doubles. She won 167 singles tournaments in her career, and to go with 177 doubles tournament, she won her last major in mixed doubles a month short of her 50th birthday at the United States Open, but she has become an important voice of political activism in this country. And leading up to this election, there's nobody I wanted to talk to more today than her. Good morning, old friend.
Good morning, Mike. Thank you for that.
Well, Martina, I was talking to a mutual friend of ours, Mary Carrillo, not long ago, and she described you this way: the most idealistic person I have ever known. Okay, now that's high praise indeed. But one of the things she referenced, kiddo, is that when you were even as a teenage tennis player, you were constantly correcting calls, even if they went in your favor. And she said it was a famous umpire named Lee Jackson. I don't know. She wasn't quite sure if it was it. Finally, Lee said to you one day, "Martina, we're just going to have to play the calls." Is that a true story?
Yes. I mean, when I started working with Bill, even Rene Richards is like, just play the call. Don't give him the points, you know. Nancy Lieberman used to get mad at me when I tried to give away points, and she said, "They don't come. They're not coming back. They're not going to give you the point back, you know, the opponent." And they were right, but I just, you know, my father always taught me, you know, call it the way you see it, and I always have. Fairness has always been very important in my life, and so I just think that's the fair way to be. My preference would be to not have any linesmen at all. You just call, you know, go on the honor system, and I would have been happy with that. But
we're talking to Martina Navratilova on the Mike Lupica Podcast, and I told her I wanted to talk politics today. And before we get to the demonization of immigrants and refugees and people coming to this country for the same reason that my grandparents came here, that people have come here for hundreds of years, I want to put it in the context of your own narrative. And you grew up in a country that had tanks in the streets, okay? And you first sought, I think, I hope I'm right on my math here, kiddo, but you first sought political asylum in this country at the age of 18 and were granted temporary residency and became a citizen 6 years later. But I want you to describe your own journey and what America, not just because of the opportunities in tennis, Martina, but what America meant to you with your background.
Well, most tennis was played in America, but that's not why. I mean, that was one reason I wanted to live here. But the biggest reason I wanted to live here because I just felt free here from the very first time I came, which was in '73. I played my first tournament was flew through New York, but the first tournament was in Fort Lauderdale, and I was just blown away. Which is incidentally, I live like 10 miles from Fort Lauderdale now. In Florida, I was blown away by just the openness of everything, and palm trees, and you could pick a coconut off the street and an orange and eat it, and it just seemed so luxurious and free and full of possibilities, you know. Never mind the fact that I was playing tennis, so I just felt very much at home. It was like coming home. It was as if I'd always. Been here or been here in another lifetime, I don't know, but it just felt very comfortable from the get-go. And then, of course, it made sense geographically because like 80% of the tournaments were played in the U.S. back then. So from a logistical standpoint, it made sense to live in America.
You were the child of you were a child of the 60s and coming of age in that year. What was Czechoslovakia like in those years? What kind of evolution was going on there?
Well, there wasn't much evolution at all. It was just the way it was from the late 40s, early 50s, when the Russians or Soviets really put their stamp on the country and made it a communist country. It had a possibility of going kind of capitalist after World War II. But in 48, the communists basically said, no, this is how it's going to be, and we're beholden to Soviet Union. And so grew up in a very communist country where you had to watch what you said. You couldn't, both my parents got thrown out of school for their political views and had much lesser value jobs than they would have had they been politically correct, for lack of a better word, and kind of towed the line and belonged to the Communist Party. They would have had high jobs. They were, you know, very smart people, but because of their political views, they got in trouble, separate and apart from each other. So they had their jobs, and it was a comfortable upbringing, very safe, and. I was never hungry, I was never cold, but it was very Spartan in that, I had like two pairs of shoes in the winter. And not because we didn't have more money, but it's just that there wasn't much available to buy. And in waiting in lines for basic necessities, I think we got a refrigerator when I was about 10 years old. About the same time we got a TV, took it home to the house in a wheelbarrow. The same wheelbarrow that we used to spread clay on the clay courts, we used to take the TV from the electric shop halfway across town to our house. So, I mean, it was a comfortable upbringing, but it was pretty barren. Let's put it that way.
We're talking to my old friend Martina Navratilova on the Mike Lupica podcast. And so then the possibility of America becomes real because of your talent for tennis. And you come here and you begin one of the great careers in the history of your sport and become half of as great a rivalry as the sport has ever seen with Chris Evert. 80 matches and you're 43 and 37. You each end up with 18 majors in singles at the end of your career. Okay.
Right.
When, Martina, did you feel that you were not, I don't want to say confidence because you had the great confidence of a great athlete. When did you become secure enough of your status in this country to find your voice politically?
I always felt that I had that because that's what America was about, right? The freedom to speak your mind and not get in trouble for it. So I never got in trouble for political views, one way or the other. I may still get in trouble back then for being too honest about what I thought, what I felt, and then being criticized for it. I'm like, okay, you wanted honesty, now you get it, and now you, you know, now you're upset with me. But it was, you know, I always felt free to speak because I knew there would be no repercussions. I wouldn't, well, first of all, being a tennis player, you have the freedom to say what you want because you're your own job, you know, like Colin Kaepernick kneels down and now he doesn't have a job anymore. I would still have a job if I was kneeling playing tennis because they can't keep me from playing tennis.
Right.
There is no team, there is no contract, you have to earn your money and you're your independent contractor. So I didn't have to ever worry about keeping quiet because I would get in trouble with somebody. Endorsements, yes, I may not be getting those, but you know, I wasn't going to get them anyway, being a gay woman. But that just, it never came into the equation for me to be quiet because, you know, I want Republicans to buy my sneakers too. So I left my country so that I could say what I feel and not worry about any kind of repercussions. So I certainly wasn't going to stop being quiet now to either make some people feel better about themselves or you know, make an extra buck for an endorsement. That just wasn't in the equation.
You know, it's funny. As soon as I finish this podcast today, I'm going to, you know, I'll be texting her and wanting to do another one because this has been such a rich and interesting and compelling life that I'm speaking to someone who has climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, is a breast cancer survivor, has been an activist in politics in so many ways. And, you know, it's funny. When I ran into Martine at Wimbledon this year. I was there with my son, Zach, and we ended up talking about politics, of course, because she is when she can, around her schedule, she is glued to MSNBC. And mm-hmm. I didn't tell you this that day, but this falls in the category of activism. And I was saying that one time Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, was on Morning Joe when I was on. And we were sitting in the green room and I said, you know, I write and we appear on this network. And sometimes I feel as if we're talking to the ocean and it's not doing any good. And he said, no, you're wrong. And he said, I'll tell you why. He said, look what you were probably writing about same-sex marriage 10 years ago. And he said, it's a drip, drip, drip effect. And sometimes you cannot see that change is happening. And I'm telling you, I know you probably get less frustrated than I do because I'm in the barrel in this world of politics, especially on television. But do you feel that you're making a difference, like right now when you're out canvassing for Andrew Gillum, who's running for governor of Florida?
Well, you have to feel that. And I'll tell you, I mean, it's like recycling, you know. You recycle because it's the right thing to do. And if you put all the piles of recycling just from the street that I live on, you're going to see that it fills a truck. So you know it's a drip, but those drops, you know, are, you know, what is the ocean but a whole bunch of drops, right? So you have to believe that you're making a difference. And so, yes, I do. And also, it just makes you feel better about the whole thing of doing your part rather than just, you know, tweeting and talking. You're actually doing something. And yesterday when I was handing out the voter guide cards to people that were coming in to vote early. It's empowering. It's like, you know, I was there for 4 hours and it flew by because I was, and people that say, oh, you have so much energy. I was running, chasing people in the parking lot. I would see where they parked the car so I could catch them on the way in so I would not actually slow them down, but tell them what I was all about, what I was trying to do. And it just felt, you know, like you're part of the process and you do feel like you're making a difference. You have to believe that. Otherwise, we would all just stay home.
Right before we started today, I asked you what it's like to knock on the door, and they open the door, and Martina Navratilova is standing there, and you suggested that it doesn't cause quite the sensation that I was under the impression that it would.
Well, yesterday when they did not, when I was canvassing for Hillary Clinton, not one person said, "Oh, you're the tennis player." No, I did not have that happen, but I was happy to just try to get people to go and vote. However, it was then that I realized that Hillary was in trouble, because most of the people that I knocked on their doors, they were not the people that were on the list. So I'd realized that the campaign was not nearly as organized as everybody thought they were, but that's another story. But yesterday, canvassing, voting out, giving out the voter guides, some people that were not voting Democratic, but then they recognized me, so then they still wanted a picture, but I'm like, no, only if you vote this way do you get a picture.
No, I saw the picture of you in the Gillum sweatshirt on your Twitter feed, and I follow your Twitter feed because you're so often retweeting the same kinds of things that I did, and so let's get to this right now, okay? Which this shameful idea that these people in the caravans are coming here to somehow destroy the Republic. I said this the other day, Martina. I wonder, you find me one person in this caravan who's going to walk into a synagogue in Pittsburgh on a Saturday morning with four guns and shoot up worshipers the way Bowers did the other day. You find me one person, but this
doesn't exist.
He's gone back to his most base instincts, to his base, which is that we have to keep people who are different out of this country.
Well, there is that. And what I don't understand is, we're supposed to be the land of the free and home of the brave. Where are the brave people? Because the Republican base seems to be so scared of everything.
Yes.
They're just so terrified. They need to have a gun on them all the time. They need to have more than one to protect their home and go shopping. And they're terrified of these people that are still like 1,000 miles away from the border. I just don't know where we got the disconnect from what actually is real and what we're afraid of, because they really are afraid of the monster that's under the bed, which actually doesn't exist. You know, but these are adults, not kids.
And
I don't understand where the brain has gone.
And this idea that we may send as many as 15 thousand American men and women in the armed services to protect a border. That,
but to do
that,
what?
To
because
do
they're
exactly
on the other side of the border. So are they going to invade Mexico now? are people going to invade Mexico? And by the way, I don't know if you saw the tweet the other day when Trump was calling this an invasion. I said, I tweeted, August 21st, 1968, 600,000 Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact soldiers came in tanks, fully armed, into Czechoslovakia.
Yep.
That's an invasion. The caravan of people that are coming through Mexico, that's a caravan of people. That's not an invasion. So these words that he's using, infestation, I mean, well, it's straight out of Mein Kampf, but that's another story. This is not the America that I came to, that I have lived in for so many years. And you know, my Twitter feed, I started Twitter in 2013 when I was just doing Dancing with the Stars, which I'd rather forget. But, you need to be on Twitter. And then I realized what a great platform Twitter is. And you can just tweet articles that you like and then make your comment. So my Twitter feed was so varied during Obama years. I was all over the map. I was talking about, you know, the cosmos and pollution and the animals here and this funny guy there. It was very varied. The variety was quite fun, and a lot of people were commenting on that. Now, the last 3 years, it's been nothing but Trump. And I wish there was a day where I wouldn't actually think about him and what he's doing to this country. I long for the day when that won't be the first thing that comes to my head. What, you know, where can I make a difference today politically? Because, you know, you don't want to live that way, but it's what it's become, because we are not the country that I defected to 40 years ago. Well, 43 years ago now. It really breaks my heart.
The great Martina Navratilova is our guest on the Mike Lupica podcast. More with Martina after I tell you about our good friends at Peter Manning Clothing. If you're tired of wearing baggy, oversized clothes, never finding your size, or having to take everything to the tailor, then I beseech you to check out Peter Manning NYC. Peter Manning has developed a fresh line of apparel specifically designed for us not-so-tall guys. Pants shouldn't bunch up at your ankles, shirts shouldn't hang down to your knees, and jackets shouldn't wear like a tent. You'll feel good and look great wearing proper-fitting clothes. They guarantee it. It's changed thousands of lives, and it'll change yours, too. No more baggy pants, no more pirate arms, and no more tailor tacks. Visit them online at www.petermanningnyc.com. Be sure to use the promo code LUPICA for 20% off your order, or check them out in Manhattan as I did at 933 Broadway and discover a great fit. I've gone there. My son has gone there. We love it. This is an honest and heartfelt recommendation. www.petermanningnyc.com. Be sure to use code LUPICA for 20% off your order. We're talking to Martina Navratilova on the Mike Lubica podcast. You know, it's so funny, and this is become a default reaction with me, and it's not my first reaction every time that there's a tragedy in this country or a gun tragedy. Mm. And I can guarantee you, over the last 10 years, I have written more columns about guns than anybody in America. And there again, I feel to no avail. Maybe there will be a change someday. But every time there's a tragedy like this, I think to myself, please don't let the deranged person with a gun be an immigrant, because they would seize on that and make it something that it's not. And when you look, Martina, you look past the most recent headline to the other headlines, and most of this is white Americans with guns walking in to a church or a military center or a mall or a meet and greet with a congresswoman in Arizona, and they start shooting. And the idea that these people are coming to kill us and rape us and rob us, if he could put a wall around this whole country, not just on the southern border, he would.
Mm. Yeah, well, yeah, the wall on the beach would not look so good. It just saddens me, because it's a self-inflicted wound that doesn't need to be there. But again, the reality has left home, because immigrants, legal or illegal immigrants are less likely to commit a crime than natural born Americans. The numbers are overwhelming in favor of immigrants, in that they are not going to get in trouble, because that's not why they came here in the first place.
Right.
Yet this is the image that's there. And now with the diseases, oh, they have diseases too. Wow. Oh, smallpox, I did not know. I thought that kind of like disappeared 50 years ago. I mean, I don't know. The reality has left the building. You know, as they say, there's not just alternative facts, but we live in an alternative universe, apparently.
And now there's this asshat notion that with a few words from his pen, he can just turn the 14th Amendment to the Constitution of the United States into dishwater, which is one of the most important amendments to the Constitution, because it was a reaction to what? The Dred Scott decision.
Didn't he swear to uphold the Constitution?
Kinda.
The Constitution is the only one that suits him. You know, the selective reading of the Constitution, just like the selective reading of the Bible, where they pick and choose which verse to go by and which one to use against people that are different.
What do you think is going to happen on Tuesday? What do you think is going to happen on Tuesday?
I tell you again. 2 years ago, I knew the Democrats were in trouble in Florida. What I have been seeing here. I'm very encouraged, because I think there are a lot of people that have never been politically involved that are not just voting, but people that didn't vote are voting, and people that did vote are doing more. They're bringing friends. They're canvassing. They're making phone calls. There is a lot more enthusiasm and volunteering and making sure that the people that should be voting are voting, etc. I really feel good about it. I think for sure we will flip the house. I mean, I don't want to count my chickens before they hatch, but I'm very encouraged by that, and we'll see. But I think this election is a referendum on Trump. Of course, he will take none of the blame. He'll blame it on Mitch and Paul Ryan, I'm sure. But I think we're gonna start going the right direction here, and hopefully get set up for 2020.
No, I was saying to a friend of mine the other day, I don't know how much time I have left on the planet, right? You know, I come from, my parents are in their 90s, so I'm hopeful, but I don't want to give six more years of it to this president. You know, I was talking to James Carville the other day on this podcast, mm-hmm. and I said to him, and I want to get your reaction to it. What has been shocking, there have been a lot of shocking aspects to this presidency. One, the complicity of the Mitch McConnells and the Paul Ryans, yep. and the Lindsey Graham, who does everything except roll over and beg now for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Okay. What shocked me is how easy it was for this, you know, for this guy to see all the weaknesses in our system and exploit them to the extent that he has.
Yeah, but that's the sociopaths. You know, they study that. They know exactly where to strike and how. Narcissists. They know exactly how to hurt you. They have no feelings, so they have no compunction about hurting others' feelings, and they know how to manipulate. That's all they've been doing. That, you know, that's how he got where he got. And so yes, it's not that he's that smart, but this is all they feed off of it, and they study it. You know, they all go to the same school. All the sociopaths, they have the same playbook. So they know exactly where to hurt you and how, and they keep going, and they don't care.
Yeah, they injure and wound and sometimes slay without compunction. How much of an influence, just in terms of the political and activist example that she has set across both of our lifetimes, has Billie Jean been for you? Because,
I would have to say not much. I mean, she has influenced, obviously, where the women are going and women's tennis and all that. But I was like that long before I came here or before any of this got started. So I think it was more,
It's who you are. It's who you are and have always been.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now you're out there going door to door. And to me, I'll tell you this, not far from, we're not actually very far from each other while we're having this conversation, okay? And I was in an early voting line the other day. I did come away. Everybody was in a good mood there. Everybody was excited. The people helping you were excited. The people in the line, I didn't hear one person bitch about it. And we didn't have a tremendous, you know, it might have been my wife and I, maybe 10 or 15 minutes. But the feeling that you got going in and coming out and getting your I just voted sticker did make me optimistic in this slog of a time for America.
Absolutely. I tell you what else made me optimistic is how many people yesterday I was trying to give that voter guide to. They already had their own voter guide. They knew exactly what they were going to do. They've done their homework. And those were the people that really excited me because I know they will affect others as well. You know, they will talk about it, and they will infect others in a good way with their enthusiasm. So that's what really gave me hope, is not just the attitude, but these people knew about all the amendments. They knew what they need to say yes on and no on, etc. You know, they knew the judges. They knew all the nitty-gritty details of what was important. So that's what gave me hope. These people are switched on. They didn't just, you know, pull the lever.
You know, I'm quoting Carville again just because he's one of the smartest people I know politically. And he has been saying to me for months, and he'll say, Mike, I don't know a lot about a lot of things, but I do consider myself an expert in intelligent women. And he said, intelligent women are going to go to the polls in record numbers in November. And I want not just women, okay, because even though women are smarter than men, okay. I always, when I go around and talk about my books, Martine, I tell the boys, and when I talk to middle graders and high school kids, I say, listen, guys, this is about the age where you get a little bit behind women. And then we just spend the whole rest of our lives trying to step up. We're smart and cool, too. It's just they're a little smarter and cooler. But we can't just put this on women. Do you think that young people are going to come out in big numbers on November 6th?
I think they'll come out in bigger numbers than ever before, but still not in as big numbers as they should. And that's where I get frustrated, because they have been affected more than anybody. They will be affected more than anybody by what's going to happen. And with the situation with the school shootings and everything that's gone on, they should be just one issue voters. And if they want to make a difference in their own lives, then they need to get up and vote just on that issue. If nothing else, it's okay to be a one-issue voter. God knows that the Republicans, so many of them, are just that one issue, whether it's abortion or gun rights or what have you. And this needs to go the other way, because for the kids to have to be doing gun drills, active shooter drills at school, on a regular basis, and to have extra police at school just in case something happens, it's just wrong, you know. It's just wrong. I mean, we used to do in Czechoslovakia, you know, the atomic bomb drill. You know, but we did that once a year for like 2 minutes, and we knew it was a joke, because if there really was a bomb going off, it doesn't matter what we do. But it's kind of, you completely forgot about it the rest of the year. Here, it's like ubiquitous. It's always there, omnipresent, and it's just wrong. It should be thinking about, you know, passing, doing well in school and getting good grades, rather than, you know, where do I hide in case I have like an emergency landing type situation where you're always aware of what you should be doing in case. I mean, it's just sad, and so it makes me upset that the kids are not more switched on. I think they should be more switched on than they are. But at the same time, we will have a lot more kids in percentage-wise voting than ever before. No doubt about that in my mind.
We're talking with Martina Navratilova on the Mike Lubica podcast. More with Martina in a minute. But first, a word from our good friends at GEICO. There's a quick way you could save money. Just switch to GEICO. All it takes is 15 minutes to find out if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. And GEICO offers coverage for more than just car insurance. Got a motorcycle? GEICO's got you covered. Got an RV? Covered. Got a boat? Covered. How about a homeowner's or renter's insurance? You bet GEICO's got you covered. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save. That's geico.com. You know, when Martina and I ran into each other at Wimbledon, I realized that if they had baseball cards for the hosts at MSNBC, she would be a baseball card collector from Stephanie Ruhle.
For
Stephanie
you
Ruhle.
You know what's sad? Because I listen to MSNBC on the radio, right? And I know who is talking.
Yeah, right.
We're not even seeing them. I know who all these people, I mean, 99% of the people are. So it cracks me
No,
up.
You need to be on these shows. You need to be on with our friend Stephanie Ruhle. You need to be on with Nicole, who's just a rock star. You need to be on with Ari Melber. You would fit right in. When you're in New York the next time, you got to tell me, because I'll be your booker. I'll try to pitch you to these shows, because you ought to. By the way,
get on a TV show? Yeah, okay.
did your head not explode over the weekend the other day? That's a bad expression, but mine. I felt like my hair was on fire. When one of the default positions from the president of the United States was that there had been an armed guard at this synagogue on a Saturday morning, and immediately people on social media were pointing out three cops got shot by this guy.
I know, it did explode, but it was predictable. I knew he was going to say that. I knew it before he tweeted that was going to come down the pike. There is a solution, more guns. You know, I read Nicholas Kristof's article the other day on NRA, basically that they should be a terrorist organization. Guns statistics, if I did my math right, because what he said was, in Japan, the people that die every day in U.S., it takes in Japan 10 years for that to happen.
Right, right.
So I prorated it, and it means that Americans are 1,000 times more likely to die by a gun than Japanese. So let's see, what's the common denominator here, or common divider, is the fact that you cannot buy a gun in Japan, but here you obviously can. So throwing more guns at it obviously is not the solution, and that's what I just, I don't know. As I said, logic has left the building.
You know, it's so tragic, and I've written this for years, and I hate it when I write it, but I know in my heart it's true that eventually you'll know someone. As a cancer survivor, you know this. You'll know somebody whose life is touched by cancer. Okay, it's almost impossible that you wouldn't. Okay, and I have said right. for years that you're going to know somebody, and it happened this year. Carl Hyacin, the great writer, columnist for the Herald, one of my dearest friends for 35 years. His brother, Rob, was one of the people shot at the Capitol Gazette shooting when the guy walked in and into the newsroom. Okay, it was inevitable that it would happen to somebody that I knew. And coming out of the world of tennis, okay, you know the Andy Murray story. You know that the Dunblane shooting that he and his brother survived. Okay. Completely changed the gun laws in that country to the point where there are rarely any. You know, when you hear a terrorist attack in London, it's a truck or a knife or a but it's never guns.
If Las Vegas never changed anything, if Parkland never changed anything, what will it take? Is there a red line there for these people to say, you know what, maybe we do need to change this? And by the way, even the Second Amendment, it was militia. They changed it to every human being not long ago when the Supreme Court ruled. Now that means everybody. Well-regulated militia means, to me, it means people that are in the armed forces, not, you know, every individual has a right to make their own militia. I mean, you know, anyway.
No, that amendment, I say this and write it all the time. The Second Amendment was written for muskets. Martina.
Exactly, and muzzle loaders.
It was for people who were 5 miles from the nearest neighbor in Virginia, okay, in the 18th century. That's what they wrote it for.
Yeah, and they were scared of Indians. I'm like, really? That's what it was, right? I mean, I understand where it came from, but we did not evolve. I think if we were writing that amendment, it would read slightly differently. And that's an understatement.
All right.
Bump stocks. I mean, are they still legal? And now they're talking silencers. They want silencers. Because and what is the best way to know that somebody's shooting a gun? You can hear it, so you run for cover. Imagine these killers will actually show up with silencers. Nobody will know what's going on until, you know, they actually get shot. It's just insanity.
It's shameful. And what
so
they
irresponsible. It's so irresponsible and so unnecessary. But again, where does this fear come from? Where I understand you won't have a gun in your home in case somebody shows up there. Okay, we have a whole bunch of dogs, don't need guns, but that's another story. But what is this fear of the immigrants or walking down the street and thinking you're going to get shot? I've never heard a gunshot on the street. I almost got shot in my own home, but that's another story. You know, it's crazy, this fear.
You almost got shot in your own...
They're called snowflakes, but they're the ones that are terrified.
Hold on. You almost got shot in your own home?
Well, that was. That's another story. I'd rather not go into that, but yes, I almost got killed when I was 24 years old.
Oh, man.
So, I know about guns. I'm a gun owner, and I'm not afraid of guns, but the idea that you need to have one in your purse or on your hip and walk around or, you know, have it in your car at all times just in case what? You know, and would you ever strike up a conversation with somebody that's packing, that's got a six shooter on their hip? Would you ever?
No, no.
You run the other way. It's like, holy shit,
Martina. Mike, the great Pete Hamill, one of the great American writers, one of the great citizens in the history of New York, when every time there is another gun tragedy and they say this is not a gun problem, it's a people problem. Pete always would ask the same question. How many home runs did Babe Ruth hit without a bat?
That's a great line. I will repeat that one.
Exactly. All right. Listen, but I'm talking to tennis immortal and political activist, my old friend Martina Navratilova. All right, I want to ask you a couple of tennis questions before we go, because if not, it would be like having the three tenors on and not talking about the opera, okay?
Okay.
When you look back on your career, Do you have any regrets that you didn't get the 10th Wimbledon? That you didn't do this, that you didn't do that? It's so funny, Martina. I haven't had a chance to talk to you about this.
Yeah.
The one concern I had about Serena going into that final against a young Miss Osaka, okay? You know what the match I thought about was? You, at the age of 37, going against Conchita Martinez, because that was one of the great age gaps, between... And I kept telling people, I said, yes, I would favor her, but I can't get that one match out of my head.
Yeah. Well, I would have loved to have done the 10th one, but I think I could. If I have a regret for my career, it's that I didn't get a coach earlier.
Really?
I didn't know any better. I didn't know any better. I was without a coach for 6 years. It's when I started, I was 26 when I started working with Rene Richards. My father was my coach, so when I left my country, I didn't have a coach. And back then, people only had coaches really in their hometown. Nobody traveled really with a coach other than Borg and Berglund and maybe Jimmy Connors and his mom, but it was unusual to have a coach. But then you would come home and get some help. I was on my own for 6 years, and so I didn't know any better. Had I, obviously nowadays everybody's got a coach or two or three. So that's my one regret, but it's not for lack of trying. I just didn't occur to me.
When the last time I spoke to Chris Evert, I asked her this question, because the obsession with majors has become such a dominant theme because of Serena, because of Fed, because of Nadal, because of Djokovic. But that obsession did not exist with you guys. And I forget, you didn't play the Australian every year, did you?
No, a bunch of years we didn't play French. Chris didn't play the French a bunch of years because we were playing team tennis. It was Wimbledon, U.S. Open, and then the Virginia Slims Championships, the season-ending championships, now called WTA Finals. That was the third biggest tournament of the year. For us, the tour was it. So, you didn't want to miss Wimbledon and the Open, but finishing number one was a bigger deal, actually, and supporting the tour. I mean, we played, and nowadays it seems the tour is just a warm up for the majors,
right?
And as soon as they get a little pull muscle, they don't play and save themselves for the French and for the Australian Open, whatever. And it's all about the majors. And I had to think back, when was it? I didn't even realize which major was my first final, and it was the French Open, but I forgot. It wasn't that big a deal. So it's a different measuring stick, and that's what makes me kind of upset that's all about majors, and that's why Serena is the greatest or Roger Federer is the greatest. Different measuring sticks. So it's frustrating because they move to finish line, so to speak.
I want to ask you again. Did I have my numbers right that you won a combined 374 singles and doubles tournaments in your career?
You had the numbers. Yeah, 167 and 177. but I'll tell you, the number that I'm proud of the most is that I won the singles and doubles at the same tournament 80 times.
80 times.
80 times. And there were only like two tournaments that I didn't play doubles. I always played doubles. It just didn't occur to me not to play doubles. So, I may have played too much tennis, but, whatever.
80 is a good number in your resume. 80 matches against Chris, 80 times when you won singles and doubles. But, okay, let me ask you this. And the great debates of sports are, Michael or LeBron, Brady or Roger, you know this, okay? It's what keeps us going. Those sorts of conversations have gone on across time and will go on forever, okay? So, if my money's on you, but I can see why people would say Serena. Okay, but here's the thing.
Yeah.
In 1983... You were 86-1. You lost one match at the French Open. So I will put it to you this way. Was there ever a better player than you then?
No. I lost six matches in 3 years.
It just was stupid. I mean, it's a ridiculous record. And so, okay. By the way, Connor says exactly what you say about the majors. He said, we were looking for a paragraph in the sports section in those days. The women had a harder job getting a space in the sports section, but they were right. building their tour at the same time. So you're in complete lockstep with him. Okay.
Yeah.
And when he was coaching Andy Roddick, I was sitting with him one day at the U.S. Open. It was the year that Roddick ended up playing in the finals against Federer. Okay.
Okay.
And I never got the question out because we've known each other. I've known him longer than I've known you. Okay. And we're still friends. And I never got the question out. And I started to ask him if coaching filled the competitive void. And I don't even remember what point I was in the question. And he turned and he gave me that look and he said, don't even effing think about it. Okay. and you still were filling that void at the age of 50. You could still play tennis at a high enough level that you and one of the Bryans could win the mixed doubles. And so it was probably stupid of me to ask you if you had any regrets because you got everything out of yourself on the tennis court that you possibly could have.
Absolutely. But, you know, the competition was, for me, it was with myself, really. How well can I do? To what level can I get? That's why I kept playing doubles. I'm like, I know I can still play better than I'm playing right now. I really felt that. And finally, that last year, I'm like, okay, I can't get any better. Now I can only get worse. Now the father time is has caught up with me again because it's only going to go downhill. And I was right, you know. It was, for me, the competition was always with myself. I mean, you've heard me say this. I've always said I'd rather play well and lose than play lousy and win, because if I play lousy and win, that just means my opponent really sucked. But if I play well and lose, then they are really good, and where can I get better? So I always looked at it that way.
You know, it's funny, and I've got a couple more minutes with you, and then I promise I'll let you go. I was telling the story the other night about Connors, and. At Wimbledon in 1987, my wife and I just decided, I hadn't been back for like 5 years, and we went, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up, she was with her mom shopping that day. I went to Wimbledon by myself, and Jimmy is playing Michael Pernforce. I don't know if you remember this match.
Oh, yeah, 6-1, 6-1, 4-1, he was down.
6-1, 6-1, 4-1. He's lost 16 out of the first 19 games of the match. None of us had any idea that 4 years later I'd be watching the same match against Patrick McEnroe in the first round. And I'm thinking, okay, I've seen everything with this guy. I've got to write his obit, okay? And, of course, you know Jimmy. He got a break and a hold. And I turned to a guy next to me. I said, he thinks he's got him right where he wants him, okay? So, right? And he comes back and wins the match, okay? Yeah. And I'm waiting for him outside the locker room afterwards. And I run into Billie Jean. And Billie Jean said that day, you know, when Borg is 50 years old, he's going to wake up in the middle of the night and wonder what if. And she said, you know what? McEnroe's going to wake up and wonder the same thing. And she pointed up to the locker room and she said, Jimmy, is never going to wonder. And right. It must be satisfying to you that you don't have to wonder.
Exactly. Exactly. No regrets. You know, because like I said, the regret was that I didn't get a coach, but I didn't know any better. So I always tried. There's never any regret about the effort and the attitude.
Thank you so much for doing this today. Right. I know you've got. I know that you have to go knock out some more doors, or kick them down,
down, baby.
You've got to hand out more pamphlets. Again, I'll go back to what our friend Mary said about you. The most idealistic person she's ever known. I am so glad that tennis gave us the opportunity to begin a friendship which continues to this day. And I hope to see you soon, but get out there and get to work today, okay?
Will do. All right. Thanks, Mike. I really enjoyed it. It was so much fun. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The great Martina Navratilova on the Mike Lupica podcast. Again, I tell you this every week. You get tired of hearing me. There's a reason why our numbers continue to grow, and it's because we are lucky enough every week, and soon it's going to be a couple of times a week, to find people that I consider interesting conversationalists. And there is no, and I will assume that so much of what she told you about her own life, you did not know. before you started listening to this podcast. So please continue to download it. Please continue to subscribe. We love doing this, and the feedback we get is tremendous, and we will talk to you next week, everybody.
The Mike Lupica Podcast is produced and distributed by Compass Media Networks in conjunction with Hiltzik Creative. For iPhone users, go to the podcast app and search the Mike Lupica Podcast. Click on the Mike Lupica Podcast icon and subscribe. For non-iPhone users, you can listen on Google Play Music, TuneIn, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast platform.